Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Today, there are more than 143,000 women engaged in fighting America's wars around the world. In fact, as of this past March, about 2% of all deaths and wounds were to women. Yet, officially, women are barred from combat. In this hour, we'll be talking with journalist Aaron Solaro, who argues that this barring of women from combat may well be the last great barrier to women's full equality of citizenship, and one that she argues should come down and, in fact, is coming down because the U.S. military, she says, can no longer fight without women. This morning, we'll be talking with Aaron Solaro about a book that she's authored. The title of her book is Women in the Line of Fire, What You Should Know About Women in the Military. It's published by the Seal Press. She is a journalist who has written on this subject, and her articles have appeared in a number of publications. She's also done a lot of interviews. She's published more than 20 articles on military affairs, including two series from Iraq and Afghanistan that were published in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Her works also appeared in Baltimore Sun, Christian Science Monitor, the Naval Institute's Proceedings, and the Marine Corps Gazette. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep moving along and get in as many callers as possible. But listeners certainly are welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, which means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and the calls on us. And that is 800-222-9455. In Champaign-Urbana, again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ms. Solaro, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. Why is it that you became so interested in the subject?
Personal reasons. I was briefly an Army Reserve officer. I've been a Marine wife. In fact, my current partner is a former Marine. And then I also understood that in the event of any future war, and this was back in 2000, the U.S. military could not function without women.
I gave some numbers right at the beginning there, and I'm sure that I got those out of some material that came with the book, and I just want to make sure that they're current. My concern is that they're not.
They've gone up.
They've gone up. Well, that's what I thought, so that's what I wanted to make sure to ask about it. So what are now the current numbers?
155,000 and counting. DOD appears to update its figures every month and then release them a month later after they've verified them.
Uh-huh.
And go ahead.
And I would just, and then for the number of women that are killed or have been wounded?
Still about 2%.
Okay. And so what is the policy regarding women in combat?
Officially, women do not serve in direct ground combat units or roles, which means infantry, armor, artillery, and special operations at battalion level and below. Battalion is about 700-ish guys. Unofficially, you are seeing women not only patrolling with infantry and special operations units to handle any women they come along and then add firepower, but you're also seeing them with these units, living and working with them as specialists, such as intelligence, medics, mechanics, what have you. Sometimes they're volunteers, and sometimes, hey, you're a soldier. We need you to do this.
Mm-hmm. So here we have what is the official policy, and yet the reality is different from the official policy.
Yes.
What, as far as you're concerned, what is the problem with women being barred from the particular units that you talked about, from being a part of a tank crew or being part of an artillery crew and dealing with some sort of large gun, or being an infantry soldier?
Institutionally, the military, and especially the Army and the Marine Corps, are about combat. When you bar a class of people from participating in combat, rather than letting them make their own personal decisions, so as many men choose not to be, say, infantrymen, including in the Marine Corps, you put them in an enormously difficult personal and professional position. You bar them rather than letting them make their choice from participating in the heart of their profession. You brand them a second class. And as we saw for the first 30 years of women's integration in the military, we saw that they were endlessly vulnerable to harassment, to disrespect, to assault, to abuse of all kinds.
Well, that I think there, that gets at a very important question, because I suppose that there would be some people, for those people who say that the ban against women in combat in these units specifically, their part of their justification for maintaining that ban is the very thing that you point to, is that we have seen, as there have been greater numbers of women in the military, we have seen significant problems with sexual harassment, sexual assault, women who are not treated with respect by their male colleagues. And I think that there are people that would say that if we have women in these other roles as well, that kind of problem, it's only going to get worse. Now, you seem to be making the argument that the fact that in part the reason that we have that problem is that women are kept out of these kinds of roles.
Yes, you're engaging in a profound dishonesty. You're saying we don't need women. And yet the reality is the military does need women. And you're lying to those service women, and you're lying to the guys. And again, that puts people in a very difficult position. The other thing is, as women have become more and more full-fledged professionals in the military has started cracking down on sexual assault and sexual harassment for quite a number of reasons. One, there are more women. Two, they're gaining rank. Three, more guys have experience with them, and amongst these guys are not only predators, who make up a very small minority of any population, but guys who disapprove of what these people are doing and are in a position to watch them and crack down on them.
So you also, I think you make the argument that is, you think that if women were fully integrated into the military, that eventually in time, particularly as younger male soldiers got used to that, that first of all, it wouldn't seem so odd, that there wouldn't seem anything unusual about it, and that once they saw women in these roles, that would change the way they think about them to the extent that they would tend more to think of them as equals, and that they would be less likely to be involved in any sort of assault or harassment?
Or tolerance thereof.
Uh-huh.
And that has happened. What you're seeing is young men and women who are A, more and more accustomed to equality because they've grown up with it, and B, you're having kind of a trickle-up effect to at least their immediate seniors. There is a profound generational disconnect between guys who've grown up having women as friends and peers and guys who haven't. And that disconnect occurs right at about the Vietnam generation and a little later, a little younger. The young men really do not have the same problems that their elders did with that. They belong to a different culture. The young people fundamentally have practical questions about how do we make this work. It's much less of an ideological or cultural issue for them.
Yeah. And I suppose you would agree with those people who would make the criticism that also that the military has, to date, maybe not done the kind of job that it should in terms of dealing with harassment of women, assault of women. That is, from the very top, the word should have got out and that said, look, this is simply not going to be tolerated. And if it happens, we're going to come down on you with the full force of military law. I would expect you would say that there hasn't been enough of that.
There has not been. And more importantly, there has not been the kind of use of a particular code, of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Memory serves, it's Article 93, and it deals with cruelty towards and maltreatment of subordinates, meaning if you don't take this seriously, we're going to charge you, because you have violated your responsibility to your troop.
Hmm.
That said, this is a problem that, while the military has a special need to deal with it, is far from unknown in civilian society.
It sounds like for part of the argument that you're making is that the reason that the combat exclusion is sooner or later going to come down is that the military, because we have an all-volunteer military, needs women. It cannot turn away women who want to do that. And we can see now, obviously now, how hard-pressed we are for military personnel. Have you talked with senior people in the military who have said, they might want to say it on the record, but have said to you, yes, in fact, we think that this is going to happen, whether people like it or not, and it's got to happen because we have to have the people?
My experience is senior people do not wish to go on the record, with the exception of the gentleman, retired four-star general Volney Warner, who wrote the foreword to the book. His granddaughter was killed in action in Afghanistan. This is an older generation, a tremendously emotional issue, not just for them, but for many people in the culture as a whole, and they see only a downside. On the other hand, military necessity is driving the opening of combat positions and probably also the combat arms to women. And finally, even if there is a draft, there are an awful lot of people who are going to say, wait a minute, your daughter is my son's friend, and I like her, and she's a great kid, but Janie's life is not more valuable to you than Johnny's is to me.
Hmm.
So that is changing, yeah, too, the belief that men should be drafted and women should not be.
Mm-hmm. So there, again, it sounds like you're saying, well, this really comes down to a basic kind of equality issue, that the difficult issue is if we start saying that we don't want our young women to be killed in combat, then I know the question you raise and the question other people will raise is, well, what that means, you want our young men to be killed in combat? I mean, there's got to be some kind of basic, if that's bad, you know, if either's bad, both are bad, but that can't be, we can't use that as a reason to exclude one group and continue to let the other ones go.
Yes, there is certainly that great moral truth. The other thing is, you know, traditionally there's been a moral bargain between men and women, which is women died until about 1940. The average American woman ran a 1 in 100 chance of dying in childbirth. And as you go back, that number climbs, and it climbs steeply. So for pretty much all of human history, women died in childbirth, and that created a binding moral obligation for men that they should risk their lives to defend those women and children. As in this country, maternal mortality rates have crashed. Women's human worth has risen. We have entirely different understanding of female physical capabilities. And that changes the moral balance between men and women when it comes to war.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Erin Solaro. She's a journalist, and she has written the book Women in the Line of Fire. The subtitle is What You Should Know About Women in the Military. It's published by the Seal Press. And it takes a look at the question of women's involvement officially in combat and whether or not it should be allowed. And questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As you explained, women are doing a lot of things in the military now, and it is putting them into situations where they're certainly come under fire, and they are compelled to respond, just like any soldier, no matter what it is you're doing,
exactly,
would be compelled to defend themselves and to defend their fellow soldiers. But that officially, women cannot be assigned to ground combat units. So we're talking about tanks and artillery and infantry, and also things like special forces and the most elite, highly trained, the Rangers and the SEALs and all of that. The women can't go into. Do you have some sort of feeling, or does someone have some sort of feeling of how many women might actually want to go into those kinds of positions if indeed that was open to women?
Traditionally, say pre-9/11, we've been told less than 10%. Now you look at the military overall, and you find that that's not that much lower, actually, than the men who are in those positions overall. Obviously, there are more guys in the infantry in the Marine Corps than there are in, say, the Air Force, which is, has just a handful of special operations people. My belief is that women are more comfortable doing it and doing it well than admitting it, admitting that they are good at this and they enjoy doing this. I talked to one woman who spent a lot of time working with 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines in Ramadi when they were just being chewed alive, eaten alive by insurgents. And I said, how do you feel about this? And she said, well, you know, I'm a woman and I'm a mother and I'm a wife and I'm not sure any parent should do this. Okay, now this is a woman who's volunteering. And I said, well, if you could, would you ask for a transfer to the infantry? And she said, no. And I said, what about if it stabilized your home life with your husband and your children? And she said, in a heartbeat. How you ask the question totally changes the answer.
I get to, explain that to me now. I guess I'm not sure that I completely understand.
This was a woman who was volunteering and could be counted upon for some extremely dangerous and physically draining missions. Mm-hmm. And she did not believe, you know, as a matter, shall we say, of ideology, that she, as a mother and a wife, should be doing this. And yet I said, if when I asked her if a transfer to an infantry unit would stabilize her home life with her and her husband and child, because her husband was also a soldier, she said, oh, yes, absolutely. So when you appeal, I think, when you recognize that women are sometimes conflicted about these roles that they do, their role as a soldier and then their role as a mother or as a wife, when you recognize that and you phrase your question so that they can honor all these parts of themselves, it will often change the answer. And I have found this talking to other women who have done this kind of work.
So it's not so much that they're thinking that somehow that's not suitable work for a woman. It's that they're thinking about all of their various obligations, particularly obligations to their family.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, there's a major disconnect between the virtues we think being a good wife and mother requires and being a good soldier requires. And yet, frankly, the disconnect is as great between being a good father and a good husband on the one hand and being a good soldier on the other.
And I suppose that you, if you opened up these possibilities to women, that there would be some numbers of young women who are not yet married, didn't have families, that maybe wouldn't have the same kind of concerns.
Oh, yes. And men's concerns change as they marry, too, and have children. Mm-hmm. You know, men who will do very dangerous things when they are single will often be much more wary in choosing the risks when they're married and have children. And for that matter, their commanders become often much less reluctant to hazard, much more reluctant to hazard them. This is not just a woman thing. It's just we tend to talk about it more about wives and mothers rather than husbands and fathers.
I think that gets at the I'm sure that there were a standard set of things that when you talk about this, you talk about women in combat, you're going to hear again and again.
Very much so.
And that this issue of how it is that that male commanders, those who have to send their soldiers into harm's way, and male soldiers who may be having women comrades, how they're going to think about the women soldiers, and is that going to influence the kind of decisions that they make? Are they going to be selectively concerned about the women's welfare, and is it going to create problems for unit cohesion? Is it going to create problems for how it is you decide you're going to allocate your forces? I mean, there could be all sorts of things that could be potential problems if anybody thinks that the women are somehow different. I mean, it seems that's a thing that you got to kind of get over, seeing all of them, no matter whether the, and women, seeing all of them as soldiers, all of them as being essentially equivalent, and that at least at the beginning, that seemed to me to be something that would be difficult.
Years ago, a Marine general, Commandant Barrow, said, you know, there's something terrible about old men asking young women to die for them. Nobody ever asked him if it was any less terrible for old men to ask young men to die for them. And I framed this to two men, one Vietnam era, one post-Vietnam era. The old man looked as though, you know, I decked him. I mean, just the stunned pain. The younger man, who had lost soldiers, lost quite a few, basically started crying. It is not easy to send young men to die, and I don't think it is, frankly, any much easier to send young men to die than young women to die. We do have this profound belief that, however, men owe this to women. And again, I believe this goes back to, frankly, very recent and very high rates of maternal mortality. But when you exclude women from combat, especially in a prolonged situation like you have now, sooner or later, you are going to see issues with cohesion and respect. And we certainly saw that in the early years of the all-volunteer force, when we saw women subjected to, frankly, open disrespect based on the idea that they were not going to be in combat.
But again, going back to what you were talking about a little earlier, the argument you're making is that somehow that disrespect is connected to the fact that there's still some discrimination going on in the sense that women don't, men can do any of the jobs, women can only do some of the jobs. And you're saying that if we said, okay, everybody's the same, everybody could do the same jobs, those kinds of disrespect issues should over time go away.
Yes, because what you are talking about is fundamentally the human and professional equality of men and women. And I'm not sure you can have human equality without slowly adding professional equality. I don't believe that the mind makes those kind of distinctions, not in an institution.
One of the other things I'm sure that comes up all the time when we talk about women in combat is relative strength of strength and size of men and women. And I don't want to be, you know, suggesting that women wouldn't be strong enough to do the job. I'm sure there are plenty of women who are stronger than me. But generally, when you look at your average man and your average woman, there's going to be a difference of size and of body strength. And you know, for certain jobs, you're pushing people to the absolute limits of their physical performance and endurance. So I'm sure that in some people, honestly, without trying to be sexist, they would raise the question, well, let us talk about being an infantry soldier. Do you think that there would be significant numbers of women who could meet the physical standard of performance that you would have to meet and that men have to meet?
Quite frankly, yes. Okay, the biggest discriminator, and the most accurate proxy for strength is height. The average man is about 5 inches taller than the average woman. This is true in the military as well. You're not going to get around that. There are plenty of women out there who are clearly taller than average. The military created this problem by requiring women to weigh less than men, in some cases up to about 13% less than a man of the same height. And in the Army, for small women, those weights were frankly more suitable for flat racing jockeys, who are famously and extremely anorexic and dehydrated, than soldiers. So the military put women in a position of having to do everything service people had to do, while often having eating disorders and sometimes full-blown anorexia. Physical strength and stamina cannot coexist with eating disorders. So the first thing you have to do is allow women to weigh what guys their height weigh. That has begun to happen in all the services. The Army has just, it's been the last service it's done the past few weeks, has finally raised its female weight standards to just a little less than what men their height weigh. So they're much more realistic. The other thing that had to happen was for the military to become more comfortable with women's athleticism. When women first entered service academies, you had faculty. People with advanced academic degrees at the Air Force Academy worrying that participation in tennis would make heterosexual women lesbian. Now the Naval Academy requires female mids to box alongside male mids. They pair them against other women. They match for height and weight. That is tremendous progress. But the military as a whole has never really integrated the lessons of women's athletics from Title IX, and that needs to happen. You can get phenomenal strength gains in women very easily simply by saying, okay, you need to take up a serious weightlifting program. And it only takes about 6 months.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Erin Solero. She's a journalist. She's done a lot of interviews and a lot of writing on this very subject. She's published more than 20 articles on military affairs, including two series based on some of the experiences and reporting she's done in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Those appeared in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. She's also had work in the Baltimore Sun, Christian Science Monitor, the Naval Institute's Proceedings, and the Marine Corps Gazette. She is the author of the book Women in the Line of Fire, What You Should Know About Women in the Military, and it's published by Seal Press. And the book makes the strong argument that this official ban against women being involved in combat and in the specific combat units that we've talked about, in armor, which essentially means tanks, in artillery, and in infantry, that ban should be lifted. And that, and in fact, that there were people, she would say that there are people in the military who might not say it openly, but who would say, in fact, the ban needs to be lifted because they cannot afford to turn away women who would want to fulfill those positions. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you'd like to join the conversation. We have a caller here in Champaign. We want to bring them in. Line one. Hello.
David, this is sort of a follow-up. I was in the active Army on special assignment at the United States Military Academy, also known as West Point, during the summer of 1976 when women first came to West Point. And it was pretty evident that women could not live up to the regular regimen in terms of physical training that the male plebes heretofore had to adhere to at West Point. And so I think, quite frankly, the West Pointers had to make it less stringent for women. So if you're talking about combat arms, armor, infantry, artillery, combat engineers, then I do believe that is a question that needs to be seriously addressed about how women can physically, unless you're willing to avoid the notion that women are physically different than men, how women can physically carry out those combat arm assignments. I know today infantry, Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan have backpacks that weigh up to 70 pounds before you even get to the weapons they have to carry. I find it incredible to believe that women perhaps could easily fulfill those physical tasks as a combat in Iraq or Afghanistan. And that's, I want a response on that.
All right. Well, Ms. Solero, go ahead.
Well, sir, I just did respond to that. In 1976, when women began to be admitted to the military academies, Title IX had been in effect for only a few years. There was a strong cultural bias against women training seriously for strength. a lot of the first female cadets at West Point were, in fact, anorexic in an attempt to conform to very unrealistic weight standards. You cannot be anorexic and physically strong at the same time. We have women now engaging in combat on attachment with Army and Marine Corps infantry, special operations, and the combat engineers. And the engineers, they are not attached. They're actually assigned.
Okay. Well, another question I have is beyond the philosophical and the physiological. Does your book contain any comparative analysis? I understand women do serve in the Israeli Army. I don't know if they have a combat exclusion. But are there other examples of countries where women are allowed to serve in the military free of any bans on combat activities?
Yes.
What are they?
You are seeing women trickling back into the combat units of the Israeli Army. There are women serving in, I know for a fact, German armored units. I have been in occasional correspondence with a female German armored officer. And she would tell you that anyone who tells you have to be Superman to do this job is lying. Now, she is a weightlifter, but that's different.
Oh, she's a weightlifter.
Yeah, most guys in armor lift to be able to manage the weight to those tracks and so on without damaging themselves.
All right, thank you.
All right, you're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Again, just to underline this point, the argument you make is that there should be women, and there should be women who could meet the same physical standards, they could carry the same kind of weight, they could put up with all the kinds of physical demands that men do, so that there is no reason that there couldn't be some number of women, as infantry soldiers, who would be able to do the job, meet the same requirements, have the same physical abilities.
Yes, I can't stress enough how much this is already happening. In fact, the military police tend to be used as infantry so much that they are called chick infantry for the number of women who've gone into that branch actually seeking combat. The other thing I'd like to point out is these tremendously high loads of weight that men are sometimes asked to carry do tremendous damage to even the largest, strongest man if he's asked to carry them more than briefly and a few times over his life. There are lots of infantrymen out there with serious orthopedic injuries. The Marine Corps is trying to do something about this and lighten the soldiers' load. We've got to get back to SLA Marshall's idea that you can't load soldiers like mules and expect them to fight.
Tell me about some of the women that you met. As I have mentioned, you spent some time in Afghanistan and spent some time in Iraq, and specifically your idea was you wanted to talk to women soldiers.
Yes, and also men, because this is an achievement not only of the women, not only what they are doing, but an achievement of many men, because we were told for about 30 years by the cultural right, even if women can do this, men cannot do this with them. They'll either be too busy raping them or too busy protecting them from the enemy to fight. They won't take orders from women. They can't handle women as professional peers, and so on and so forth. And this has not turned out to be true. I'm not saying that all the sisters are brave and strong and all the brothers are virtuous, but so many are so much of the time that what we've seen is nothing short of a profoundly positive cultural revolution in the United States military.
Hmm.
This is a male triumph as well as a female triumph.
Well, let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Charleston. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I spent four years in the Army Security Agency during the Vietnam period, and sitting on my behind on a mountaintop in Germany, monitoring the Soviets' radar systems. obviously was something that a female could do, although we had none there at the time. And so, you know, your point about women being able to do almost anything is certainly well taken. And my question is that, you know, during the Vietnam era, there were at a peak maybe 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and of those, maybe 10% or so were considered frontline combat troops, and the rest in some various support roles. I don't know how much the head and the tail have changed since that time, but I think maybe those distinctions are somewhat artificial anyway, because an awful lot of the casualties, at least in Iraq, seem to occur not necessarily with as much with frontline troops as it is with people in support positions, like driving trucks and the like, where they get attacked by improvised devices or terrorists and so forth. And so I wonder if the combat distinction is really somewhat obsolete at this point. I'd like to hear your comments.
Very much so, and I would point out that even in Cold War Germany, if you'll remember the old Soviet operational maneuver groups coming at you, those guys weren't going to make any distinction between, say, women in an intelligence unit or a logistics depot and frontline infantry if it came to fighting them and killing them.
Right.
So this was always kind of a bad faith argument on the military's part. They knew women were going to die in combat, and because they tend to be in high-value units like ASA or logistics units or what have you, that they would die in disproportionate numbers, actually, to their numbers in the military as a whole. But this was covered up by the fact that we expected to go nuclear in a matter of days. And so a lot of stuff was hidden by that fact. Now the military is really having to deal with the fact that women do fight. Women are going to have to fight, and they have to be trained for it. And I would argue that dumbing down female physical requirements, as opposed to, say, asking women to do a little less in the upper body and a lot more when it comes to endurance running, which is those are physiological differences, does not do women a favor. That strength and stamina and wanting women to be strong and have stamina are actually beneficial not only to the women but to the military as a whole. And you need to train women for combat. There's no question anymore.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have someone here on calling from cell phone on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Are you talking to me?
Yes.
Hi. I am retired from the Marine Corps. I enlisted, and then I was commissioned, and I served during the Vietnam era. I haven't heard all of your show, not sure all of your guest qualifications. Heard she is a journalist. I strongly disagree with what I've heard her say. Equality, equal rights for women does not mean treating them like men. Men and women are not the same. Men and women. Women are smaller, weaker, slower. I strongly protested blending of the sexes to come up with a unisex. And I would also like your guest in stating her opinion to say that it is what she thinks or she believes rather than it is a fact.
Well, Ms. Solara, you want to respond?
Well, I've never said equality means treating women the same as men or men the same as women. And I think I've been pretty candid about physical differences between men and women. But looking at the experiences of service women from a historical perspective, there is no question that life is much easier for military women today, with a larger percentage and more roles they can fulfill, than it was when service women were either a tiny minority or stringently segregated. I've heard a lot of horror stories, and frankly, the horror stories get fewer the more women there are, and the less segregated they are.
Well,
I'm not saying that you know, individual women, even very early on, did not have great experiences, because I know some who have. And I respect you for your service and your own perspective, but I'm speaking on an institutional overview.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't interviewing people and that kind of thing. You can be on the outside looking in, but women do not belong in combat. Like I said, they are not strong enough. And this, you know, blending the distinctions between the genders is not helpful. And it's happening throughout society, not only in other places, but, you know, thankfully the Marine Corps still trains men and women separately in boot camp. And, you know, they're not interchangeable, but, you know, there are differences. Rethink this, you know, because it sounds like you maybe started with a precept before, doing your interviews.
Yeah, go ahead,
Well,
Sarah.
I did start with a bias, which is, quite frankly, that service women are professionals, and that means they should be treated as professionals, and that includes, you know, picking and choosing their risks and their virtues in their profession the same way their male peers do. And I think most women are probably more realistic about their capabilities than many men. If anything, they are inclined to underestimate their physical strength and stamina. One of the things I've heard from men over and over again is that service women are much more capable physically and aggressively than they've ever been led to believe women were. But this is part of the Title IX revolution. This is part of the revolution in women's athletics that has occurred since the mid-70s.
I can't imagine what would be a benefit of putting women in combat. And, you know, I heard you talking about size and so forth. I'm 5'10", and I'm not stronger than any man I know, and I'm not as strong as any man I know, even in, you know, my youth, and men are stronger. I mean, that's just, you know, the way of the world. And, I could see that, you know, women would be a deficit in a combat unit because, and men and women doesn't work well together. It doesn't. Having been in military service, you'll be treated professionally, but you're not going to be treated the same. You're not going to be part of it. It just doesn't work. There's the differences, and they're not going to end. And you know, every man's got a mother, and the way he feels toward women is going to start with that, and you know, going into combat with them it's not a good idea.
Well, I understand how you feel, ma'am. But the fact is, we do have women in the military today engaging in combat alongside men. We have had women win combat action ribbons in the Marine Corps and Bronze Stars with Vs and even the Silver Star in this war in Iraq for engaging in close combat and, frankly, sometimes on behalf of men. I have sometimes seen that the smallest person on patrol in a bunch of men was the female medic carrying the heaviest pack. So this is happening. Whatever we think of it, these are the facts.
I want to thank the caller. I appreciate her comments. We have about maybe 4 or 5 minutes left. Our guest is Erin Solaro. As I've mentioned, she is a journalist. She has written about military affairs for a number of publications, including she's done 2 series based on her conversations with soldiers, men and women, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those were published in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. She's authored a book. It's titled Women in the Line of Fire, What You Should Know About Women in the Military. The CL Press is the publisher. Do you think, given that even if we decided that this would be a good thing to have women in combat, it would be a difficult thing to sell, I think, to a lot of a lot of Americans, that what's more likely to happen is a continued kind of blurring of this distinction, the one that we've talked about, the one that says, well, no women in combat, except the fact that women do, because of the jobs they do, they are in combat, and also because in the kind of conflict we're talking about, at least in Iraq, and I'm sure in Afghanistan, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no front line. In a sense, like the front line's everywhere, and everybody is vulnerable to some extent. So that these distinctions between combat and non-combat are so blurred now. You think that what will continue to happen is that maybe they will continue to blur. Who knows? Maybe someday the combat exclusion of women would be lifted, but my sort of feeling is that that's not going to happen anytime soon.
My belief is we will start seeing a debate, some of it rational, some not, much of it, quite frankly, not. A lot of it driven by the religious right as this becomes a hot-button issue, and at the same time as a Democratic House and Senate open up conversation on this subject, because everything is now on the table. Sooner or later, and I believe sooner, the military is going to have to deal honestly with its service women. And this means particularly the Army and the Marine Corps, and fundamentally say they have earned their equality. Whatever I think, and again, I cannot stress how strong the generational disconnect is. Whatever I personally, as an older man, think, these women have earned the right to be treated as soldiers, as Marines, to make their choices about what they think that they are capable of, for us to be honest with them that we are going to need them to engage in combat. And if they are willing to do this, they deserve our professional respect and professional treatment. And that cultural change is already happening, because I've seen this happen to older military men, retired guys on several lists I belong to. Guys saying, I know what I feel emotionally, but these are the facts, and I respect these women. And they deserve this.
Well, let's try and get at least one more caller here. Champagne is up next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Two kind of related things in rebuttal to the previous caller's commentary about her perception of women's capabilities. I do, in the civilian world, what was traditionally considered a man's job. I have children who perceive me as a capable woman. And I think that, yes, we have our sons and they revere us, but what they revere us for will be different in 20 years. I hear her saying things that were kind of the same things that people said about blacks in the military 40 years ago, and, you know, integration. Our abilities and the way we fit into a particular field will be different than the way it is with men, but they're just as capable and have just as much ability to perform an essential service. And it bothers me to hear people talking about limitations. I think the nature of integration in the military or integration racially is all based on our ability to perceive ourselves as capable of anything. And how we perform that may have different attestations, but that's the job of the military, is to figure out how to realize women's dreams in that field. So that's all. I kind of was talking to her and
yeah,
not your interviewer.
I appreciate the comment. I don't know, Ms. Solara, you want to respond to that at all?
Well, you know, I would say that that the perceptions of what women are capable of have changed radically since about 1973, when the draft ended and the military began to mainstream women. Women who lifted weights, women who worked out to make themselves physically stronger so that they could do their job, for example, and often do it without being injured, were often looked at with great suspicion, if not actively accused of being lesbian. This has really started to change, and it's fairly common to hear a woman say, yeah, I'm going to go lift tonight, want to work out with me. And those changes have made women more physically capable. And
I'm not just talking about physical capability, though, but with any field, within any field,
and yet,
women will find their way to compete with men in
or to do
intellectually,
things
physically, or just in the ability to perform something of value within that circle. And it doesn't
This is true. What I would say is not just compete with men, but work together with men.
Together.
And I would say, too, as women, we have an enormous stake in equality. And equality has to be defended.
We're at the point where we're going to have to finish. And again, I want to thank the caller. Just your thinking is, Ms. Lara, that, well, this is a something that has come up for debate and discussion every once in a while. Do you think that sometime in the near future we are due for a real serious social conversation about
I believe about this? So. I believe that the numbers are driving this, and frankly, the generational changes in the military have been deep enough and strong enough that this is not a wild-eyed, radical feminist pie-in-the-sky dream. A lot of these guys have had substantial experience with physically capable women, and they're realizing, yeah, women not only can do this in theory, but they're doing this. And they deserve all the professional standing that goes along with it.
All right. Well, the book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Women in the Line of Fire, What You Should Know About Women in the Military, published by the Seal Press, by our guest, Erin Solara. Ms. Solara, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, and a happy Thanksgiving to you and your listeners.
And to you as well.
Thank you.